are here with Rob Silverman, our last brown bag speaker of the season. We thought it was going to be spring, but we're kind of ending winter. I want to thank Jen Bissell for all her help, and of course Bob Graddick. We have a new person here at UXER, Liz Monk. This is her first week, so everybody get a chance to talk to Liz afterwards. We're really happy today to have Professor Silverman from the University of Buffalo as our brown bag speaker. He'll be talking about shrinking cities. Are we still citing affordable housing in neighborhoods of opportunity? This is a HUD study that he's doing with Kelly Patterson, University of Buffalo, and includes the city, includes Pittsburgh as one of the areas. He'll talk about that in terms of what we're doing about citing affordable housing and what some of the repercussions have been. Rob's expertise is in community development and inequality in urban communities. He does a lot on gentrification issues, on housing issues, on changes in cities, and in particularly in shrinking cities. He's in the University of Buffalo and professor in the Urban and Regional Planning Program in the School of Architecture and Planning. We, as I said, we've had other folks from his department here, so we're always happy to have people from Buffalo here. We always feel kindred spirits to our fellow shrinking cities folks in terms of research, and there's always good parallels between Pittsburgh and Buffalo. Rob, welcome to UXER.
Okay, thanks, Sabina. All right, well, first of all, thanks for inviting me down to talk at the Brown Bag. I am, like Sabina said, working on a pretty multi-dimensional project, and so I'm not going to try to go over everything today, but I'm sure afterwards, after I talk about this one piece, if you have questions about other things related to the project, I'll probably be able to bring some of that other information in. But what I wanted to talk about today was, you know, a part of our preliminary analysis from our HUD Sustainable Communities Research Grant, which is called Sustainable Affordable Housing in Shrinking U.S. Cities, developing an analytic tool for citing subsidized housing and evaluating HUD program outcomes. And so I'll be talking more about the last part of that today than the analytic tool, although I'll kind of give you some insights into where we're headed in terms of having that housing suitability model that we're trying to create. And like Sabina said, I'm working on this project with two other faculty members at UB. One is Kelly Patterson, the other is Lee Yin. And so we have people from both the planning department and also the social work department looking at some of these different issues related to siting of affordable housing and coming up with new models for bringing in aspects of neighborhoods of opportunity into consideration when we do that type of siting. For the overall project that we're working on, our general focus can really be kind of summed up into three main components. One is that we're trying to examine where HUD-subsidized housing is currently located and get an understanding of how that relates to neighborhood demographics, which we're using kind of census tract-based data to kind of define those neighborhood boundaries in order to look across different cities. And then also, we're trying to identify linkages between anchor institutions and affordable housing, because from discussions with HUD and with others at conferences and other venues, we've, you know, been introduced to the whole concept of anchor institutions as one important piece of understanding how opportunities are made more available to people in low-income housing if they're located near some of those types of opportunity structures that anchor institutions like hospitals and universities and other large institutional actors you know, are present where those types of housing are located. And then the last thing we're trying to do is develop a housing suitability model that takes those neighborhood of opportunity characteristics into consideration so that housing can be sited a little bit differently than it has been traditionally by HUD, where a lot of times considerations like land values and getting low-cost land in order to develop affordable housing, and also looking for neighborhoods where they have been impacted by poverty in order to create opportunities rather than to move where opportunities are already present, is a bigger consideration in siting. And some of the data I'll show you will kind of allude to that. Yes?
I don't want to jump the gun, but will you be talking about what HUD-subsidized programs are going to be in your sample and how, as opposed to, for instance, tax credit developments, which are not technically HUD?
Right. Yeah. I'll kind of talk about that a little. We're looking mostly at housing choice voucher, public housing, and other subsidized housing projects that HUD works on. We don't really consider the low-income housing tax credits, partly for the reason you just mentioned, but also because a lot of the other subsidies come into play to assist renters in accessing some of those low-income housing tax credit properties once they're constructed. So that's kind of separate from our analysis.
Just wanted to make sure. Thank you.
Oh, sure. And so like Sabina was saying, in our HUD study, we're actually looking at 10 different metropolitan areas across the U.S. that have experienced the highest level of population decline in the last decade. And so we look at a Brookings Institute study where these 10 cities were identified as the fastest shrinking cities in the U.S. They include Birmingham, Buffalo, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Dayton, Detroit, New Orleans, Pittsburgh, Toledo, and Youngstown, Ohio. And, you know, predominantly they're located in the Midwest, in what people refer to as Rust Belt cities or places that were impacted by deindustrialization. But we also have some southern cities in our sample as well, when you look at New Orleans and also Birmingham, which share some of those same characteristics in terms of loss of industry and employment, which has led to population decline. And, of course, New Orleans also has had some natural disasters that have also impacted and sped up the process of depopulation as well. And so these are the cities that we've been looking at in our study. And what I want to do today is talk about them in the aggregate, and then I'll also look at a couple of case studies, Pittsburgh and Detroit specifically. And what we're trying to do is really look at this particular question today. And the question is HUD subsidized housing located in neighborhoods of opportunity? Because before we get to the point where we want to actually develop a suitability model for siting housing in neighborhoods of opportunity, we want to first kind of find out how well housing is already being sited in those types of locations. And so the question about what a neighborhood of opportunity is often comes up when we enter into these types of discussions and talk about anchor-based approaches to neighborhood revitalization and also housing development as well. And it's a question that doesn't have a real clear answer currently. And in fact, if you look at some of the HUD data and the HUD reports and other reports about what a neighborhood of opportunity is, there's a lot of equivocation about the exact things to measure in terms of what constitutes opportunity within a neighborhood setting. And so by going through the literature and looking at a number of different reports and different issues, we've tried to define this a little bit better so that if siting was pursued with neighborhoods of opportunity in mind, there would be certain characteristics to actually look for. And so for us, what constitutes a neighborhood of opportunity is first a community that has low levels of socioeconomic distress. And so even in declining cities, there are nodes where you see some level of revitalization and development and growth and economic vitality. And so partly a neighborhood of opportunity includes finding those geographic areas. Also a neighborhood of opportunity is economically and racially and also a cohort or generationally diverse area. And so we're looking for places where there's a mix of incomes, age groups, and also racial and ethnic groups, where exposure to different groups and cultures and generations is also a part of the neighborhood experience. In addition to that, a neighborhood of opportunity should have a mix of housing, which would include tenure, both owner-occupied and renter-occupied housing, but also a tiered housing structure where there's entry-level housing for low-income housing groups. And then also as individuals develop their human capital, find employment, and also find other benefits from living in neighborhoods of opportunity, you know, the access to other levels of housing where people could kind of maintain their residential location, but also, you know, expand their housing opportunities is something that should be a component of a neighborhood of opportunity as well. Another thing that comes up a lot in discussions about neighborhoods of opportunity is the idea of having transit access. And that includes both public transit as well as walkability in neighborhoods. And especially my colleague Lee Yin is looking a lot at kind of this component of neighborhoods of opportunity and trying to understand how housing mixes play into transit and walkability. And then the density of public services and amenities, which include both cultural amenities like libraries and museums and recreational amenities like parks, public safety, which gets into both crime and police protection and various types of urban design, and also retail and various types of consumer amenities are a consideration about what a neighborhood of opportunity would contain. And then the proximity to jobs or clusters of jobs is another consideration that comes into play about neighborhoods of opportunity. And you know, kind of superimposed over that is the whole idea of being proximate to anchor institutions, which provide a lot of these resources, but also sometimes are drivers for investment in communities as well in terms of new development and construction, and also potential partners for the development of affordable housing if it's linked to some of those development projects. And then finally, which really isn't the last thing on our list, but a very important consideration, is access to high-performing public education. And so we also look at some education data in order to understand where high-performing schools are located in relationship to subsidized housing. And so we start with this point about looking at subsidized housing location and try to kind of find out how well some of these institutional factors related to neighborhoods of opportunity are correlated with where subsidized housing is currently located, so that we can then build a model to improve those types of outcomes if the two things aren't lining up well. And so let me kind of talk about our preliminary analysis a little bit. I'll start out by showing you some of the aggregate data for the 10 cities, and then we'll look more closely at a couple of case studies that both reflect some of those aggregate trends and also diverge from them in noticeable ways. And so first I want to kind of talk about the 10 cities in the aggregate and just give you a general picture of what subsidized housing looks like in them. And I kind of put on this slide a couple of other columns just to kind of indicate to you that there is another component to this analysis that I'm not going to be talking about today, which is a separate analysis that we did of suburban tracts in the MSAs, because there are very different dynamics that take place in terms of subsidized housing siting in suburban tracts versus urban tracts. And so what I'm going to focus on today is really the core city tracts in our 10 cities, and there were 1,228 of them. And we did some both descriptive and also regression analysis looking at how some of the neighborhood characteristics were correlated with subsidized housing siting. And so the main thing to kind of really understand about all of these urban tracts is that the percent of housing units in those tracts that are subsidized housing in the aggregate was on average about 11.4% in a census tract in any of those cities. And it was broken down in terms of the type of subsidy, and we have more detailed data about all the subsidies, but the two main types of subsidies were housing choice vouchers, which are that Section 8 voucher and certificate program that got merged together about 12 years ago. And that made up about 69.4% on average of the subsidized housing units in a tract. And then the other one that we kind of highlight, at least in this particular analysis, are the percent of HUD subsidized units that are public housing. And they constituted about 12.2% of subsidized housing units in the average tract in the cities. And so the thing to really kind of focus on is that vouchers make up the preponderance of most subsidized housing units in core cities. And that's a pretty constant kind of percentage across all the cities that we looked at. And so, you know, when we think of subsidized housing, it isn't traditional public housing that we're typically talking about, although they do have distinct impacts on outcomes in terms of where subsidized housing clusters in older, shrinking cities. And so we had a lot of different data from the American Community Survey that we brought into our analysis, and we did factor analysis with it in order to identify key components of those variables that influenced housing siting, or at least were related to housing siting. And this is some of the raw data, at least some of the numbers for the 10 cities to kind of look at. And what this data really kind of shows is that from a demographic standpoint, the core cities that we looked at were pretty typical of what we would expect to see in terms of older industrial cities. They had high unemployment rates. They had a significant amount of median gross rent that was based on household income, about 38% of household income was spent on rent in the typical track in most of these cities. They had high poverty rates, where you know about a third of the population on average lived below poverty in tracts in those 10 cities. And then also they had pretty moderate levels of income inequality or mixed income neighborhoods represented within those tracts, if you look at kind of the last measure, the Gini index. And of course, they were also predominantly majority minority cities as well. And that varied a little bit across some of the cities we looked at, but all those characteristics were pretty consistent in the 10 cities. Also, when we looked at the housing characteristics, again, in all 10 cities, the housing stock was relatively old, kind of built just before the post-World War II boom. But still, a large proportion of the housing was composed of single-family homes. And when you looked at tenure, housing ownership, and rental status were fairly even, but most were predominant or majority renter cities. And the other thing to really kind of focus on is that there was a high level of vacancy in all of the core cities. And on average, 22.3% of the units in a typical tract in those cities was vacant. And the other number about vacant other is very important, because what vacant other reflects are long-term vacancies in those cities. And often that's used as a proxy for abandonment or long-term vacant properties that have not been occupied and are in some state of disrepair. And in all of those cities, on average, 54.8% of the vacant units in a tract were actually in that vacant other category. And so there's a high level of structural distress that's reflected in that particular statistic at the neighborhood level in the cities. And so when we did our factor analysis and we took all of our demographic variables, and there were more than just the ones I showed you, but those were the main variables, what we were able to do is reduce the characteristics down to really four factors that we then used in our regression analysis as kind of control variables to understand the location of subsidized housing. And they included socioeconomic distress, which was really the most influential factor in most of our models. The single family setting of a neighborhood in terms of how predominant single family characteristics were found in the neighborhood, kind of your traditional suburban style neighborhood within city boundaries. The Social Security cohort, which was really a reflection of what proportion of residents were in the retirement years and receiving Social Security as a source of income. And then also income inequality or mixed income setting of a neighborhood. And so those four factors really, were what was identified as the key components of all the demographic variables that we analyzed from the American Community Survey. The other thing, of course, that we did is we created a number of dummy variables and other measures of those institutional factors that I talked about related to neighborhoods of opportunity. And of course, the top two relate to anchor institutions, the percent of tracts that had at least one hospital or one university within their geographic boundaries, and also other kind of amenities like public libraries, parks, transit lines, which were highly accessible in most of the core cities, tracts with at least one school, and then the school performance measures, whether the tracts had one school meeting its academic year progress requirements under No Child Left Behind, or if there was one school at least in a tract that did not meet those requirements. And then we also created kind of a job density measure, which was just basically the ratio of the number of jobs divided by the total population. So we tried to standardize that a little to kind of get a sense of how dense employment availability was within a census tract. And so all of those variables were also included in our models. And when we ran our models, what's interesting is this is the result we got. And our dependent variable was the percent of total housing units that were HUD subsidized across the 10 cities. And so when the percent of housing units increased, the significant variables that are highlighted in red were correlated with that particular outcome. And when the percent of housing units that were HUD subsidized decreased in a census tract, these green variables were correlated. And so it's pretty consistent with what people think when you think about the programs and the different characteristics that we're talking about, because of course the strongest kind of correlate with the location of subsidized housing with socioeconomic distress. And that's kind of the problem that HUD kind of came to us originally with when we started working on our project, is that we have a lot of subsidized housing in distressed neighborhoods, but how do we kind of get the housing closer to opportunity structures? And of course, the second largest had to do with when that proportion of subsidized housing was increasingly public housing units. And so distressed neighborhoods, public housing, you get higher concentrations of subsidized units in general. And then when you look at other factors that were kind of working against that tendency towards more concentrated subsidized housing, things like single family settings, the Social Security cohort in terms of elderly households, income inequality, so as neighborhoods became more mixed income, the proportion of subsidized units declined, and of course, vouchers. And so when housing vouchers were more a larger proportion of subsidized housing, we saw less concentration as well, which is kind of good news for people who look at things like the MTO program and other types of voucher-based strategies for subsidized housing, because they do seem, at least in our models, to have that deconcentrating effect. But the thing that's really interesting to me about these results is this kind of cold area, this blue area, because these are all those institutional measures. None of them were correlated with the percent of subsidized housing units in a tract. And so anchor institutions, employment, amenities, school quality, none of that seemed to be influential in terms of predicting or at least being correlated with where HUD subsidized housing concentrated. And so all of these things that we think about in terms of neighborhoods of opportunity weren't happening, or at least aren't happening currently. And so there is a need for a different model for siting housing based on this particular outcome. And so that's in the aggregate when we look at all 10 cities.
Even not significant, though, the negative sign with at least one school in a track is,
Oh, right, at least one school in a track led to less. Yeah, that is kind of interesting, the direction that some of those coefficients go. And the other thing is, and I won't get into it too much, but when we did the suburban models, all the coefficients flip in direction. And so, you know, it doesn't work out as well as we'd like it to. So let's kind of look at something a little more tangible, and we can look at the case of Pittsburgh, which is instructive because Pittsburgh kind of falls into line with a lot of those general tendencies across all 10 cities. And Pittsburgh, again, is very similar. About 11.7% of units in a tract on average are HUD subsidized. So it's only about, you know, 1 in 10 units, roughly. But the percent of subsidized units receiving vouchers is actually a little bit lower in Pittsburgh than the average for all 10 cities. And the percent of subsidized units that were public housing is actually a little higher. And keep that in mind, because the results will kind of surprise you a little. So that's just kind of a little hint into what's coming. So the suspense is building. Here's a map of Pittsburgh. Hopefully the map is at least something that looks familiar to you. Otherwise, we did something wrong with our maps. Yes?
You find voucher use correlated with whether the jurisdiction was a right move to work?
Was it whether it was a what?
Move to work, public housing.
Oh, like an MTO type?
I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking not the right phrase, but where it gives
moving opportunity.
It gives up public housing authorities more flexibility in using vouchers, and you might see less utilization of vouchers in public housing.
Oh, right. I mean, vouchers are really kind of market based. Rent vouchers.
I'm not coming up with the phrase, but
there is a Section 8 project-based program. That's a separate. Yeah. That's a separate measure.
Doesn't moving to work allow housing authorities not to utilize as many vouchers as non-moving
towards
site work? Well, yeah, there are more incentives to disperse the vouchers and things like that. I don't know if we looked specifically at that question in our analysis. It's more kind of an aggregate analysis, but I can go back and look at our data to answer that a little better. But anyhow, well, this is Pittsburgh. And what this map shows are two important things. One is the shading of the map. The darker it gets, the higher the percentage of subsidized housing units in a census tract. And the little red and blue dots are point estimates of where hospitals and universities are located or at least hospital system built properties are located in the city as well. And the hospitals are red and colleges and universities are blue. And so, you know, in terms of anchor institutions is one component of that neighborhood of opportunity approach to siting housing, what we can see is that currently, you know, subsidized housing clusters outside of tracts where anchor institutions are located for the most part in Pittsburgh. Although some of that clustering is in very close proximity. Like if you look at kind of close to the area we're in, there's a lot of subsidized housing in neighborhoods just, I want to say, west of the main kind of University of Pittsburgh kind of center area. And so that's kind of our dependent variable. That Section 8, I'm sorry, that subsidized housing concentration measure. And then you can see the anchor institutions there too. When we look at the other statistics for Pittsburgh, when you look at the demographic numbers, one of the things that really stands out is Pittsburgh does a little bit better on most of these measures than the other 10 cities. You know, things like the poverty rate, the unemployment rate, the percent of rent that the percent of household income paid towards rent, all those measures are a little bit lower than the other 10 cities on the whole. And so Pittsburgh has more public housing, a little bit fewer vouchers, and on most of the demographic measures, the numbers are a little bit lower in areas where you'd like to see them in terms of measuring poverty and distress. And when you look at some of those characteristics mapped out, here's the racial composition of Pittsburgh, and you can see that African Americans are more concentrated kind of up here in the northeast and west and in areas away from those anchor institutions. You can see that the percent of the population with less than a high school education is clustered a little bit differently, but also away from those anchor-based institutions. And then poverty, you know, it has a slightly different pattern. There's more kind of poverty concentration kind of in this central area around the anchors, but not in some of those areas where you see the lower educational attainment and the minority population. And then
student factor.
And you have the student factor in terms of measuring income. And also the seniors that might be located in those areas. And then when you look at the Gini index, again, that kind of comes up in a different way because you see some diversity in terms of income, kind of, is this Shady Side? Right, in these types of areas, in Squirrel Hill, where you have kind of more mixed income populations, which is another thing that we were identifying as kind of a characteristic to strive for with a neighborhood of opportunity. So there's that tiered housing and a mixture of income and demographic groups. And then when we looked at the housing characteristics, again, you know, Pittsburgh is, you know, just barely a majority renter city, but has a slightly lower vacancy rate than most of the other cities in our sample. And still, though, there's a high level of vacant other properties within that area. And again, the single family homes are important to keep in mind because those are kind of your inner ring suburbs that were designed as kind of traditional suburban style neighborhoods with predominantly single family structures in them. And when you look at that particular variable kind of on a map, again, you can see where a lot of those single family homes are located in Pittsburgh. And again, they're kind of outside of the central area and away from those anchor institutions. And then when you look at the vacancy rate, it kind of, you know, moves in a different direction in terms of where vacant housing is clustered. It gets closer to the core, and it's also overlapping with some of those anchor institutions as well. And so vacancy is important because it shows where there's opportunities for people to relocate and move closer to those other places where other amenities might be present. You know, and just, you know, the green things on the map are all parks, in case I didn't mention that before. And then, of course, when we look at our institutional variables that worked into our model, again, you know, Pittsburgh's a little bit different than the other cities. It's got lots of parks. You know, about 41% of tracts have at least one school in them. Unfortunately, about 33% of tracts have at least one school that doesn't meet AYP standards, which is a issue in many core cities in terms of low-performing schools. And a very small percent have at least one school meeting AYP, which is another consideration in terms of neighborhoods of opportunity. Of course, it has this kind of large ratio of jobs to population because there are some large institutional employers in some of the census tracts that kind of artificially been pulling that number up.
We're also one of the places that has the highest daytime population.
Right. There's a lot of commuters coming in from outside of the city, and that's kind of reflected in that number. Yeah. If you remember from the sample as a whole, it was about 0.93. And you'll see when I show you Detroit, it's much lower than that. And so again, Pittsburgh's interesting for a couple of reasons. The strongest indicator of where subsidized housing was located was socioeconomic distress. And the standardized coefficient is huge compared to some of the other ones that we had. It's 0.618. And it's also the only thing that's significantly related to increasing percentages of HUD subsidized housing. The thing to notice is that units that were public housing is not significant. And that's despite the fact that Pittsburgh had, you know, a slightly higher percentage of public housing units in a typical track. And so although there are, you know, higher percentages of public housing units in a typical track, they seem to be more dispersed than what you might find in some of the other cities. And then, of course, the other kind of significant variables, are similar to what you saw in the larger model. And again, you know, the institutional factors are not correlated with subsidized housing concentrations at the tract level. And so Pittsburgh is interesting because it does follow a lot of the same patterns as the other eight cities, and that's kind of what this slide talks about. But also, you know, some of the demographic characteristics and the housing characteristics are a little different in terms of lower levels of distress, you know, across the city itself. And so Pittsburgh has a little better footing, but the outcomes seem to be very similar to the other cities. And these are kind of just some summaries of the other cities. And what I'll show you here is, you know, I didn't do the models for all the cities for this presentation, but what I did do is I created this kind of matrix where you can see the other eight of the other 10 cities where, again, socioeconomic distress was positively correlated with the percent of subsidized housing units in all but one, which was Birmingham. And then the other thing that was very influential was the percent of housing choice vouchers, which was negatively correlated with the concentration of subsidized housing. And some of the other variables came up kind of in a less frequent pattern across all the other cities when we ran the regression analysis. And only one institutional factor was significant. And that was in Cleveland, where at least one school in a track meeting AYP standards led to higher concentrations of subsidized housing. And that's kind of a good thing, because if you think about how programs like Move to Opportunity were designed to work, the idea is that to move subsidized housing closer to some types of opportunities, especially things like schools. And at least in Cleveland, that seemed to be happening, because these are, you know, better performing schools. In our other models, when we looked at the suburbs, unfortunately, where subsidized housing did cluster was closer to poorer performing schools in the suburbs. So at least in Cleveland, in Cincinnati, in the core city, we got kind of a different result. But that was just the only place, other than Detroit, which I'll show you in a second, where any of the institutional factors were significant.
I'm sorry, I got a little lost. Where does race fit into your four categories there?
Well, it's kind of split across these four factors that we extracted with factor analysis. So race is kind of intercorrelated with income, with educational attainment, with homeownership, with all those different factors.
I thought it was interesting that in the average city, over 50% were Black, mm-hmm. but in Pittsburgh, only 30% were
right.
Black. And does that play into any of your analysis at all, or no, not really?
Well, it does, but the only place where we're really seeing it is where, you know, race is intercorrelated with some of these factors, especially things like socioeconomic distress, and also income inequality. And so, you know, where those variables are coming up more significant, the parts of race that are tied in with those other demographic characteristics, you know, are influencing it when that's kind of showing up in the model. But race is so intercorrelated with all the other demographic variables. When you run factor analysis, it ends up kind of loading on some of these more general characteristics. And when we look at Detroit, you'll see Detroit's at the other end of the spectrum in terms of our 10 cities, especially when you think about race. And that's what this particular model is going to show you. But Detroit is different. And I lived in Detroit for a little while. Some of the data was a little bit surprising to me, but the trends in Detroit make a lot of sense when you start thinking about Detroit. First of all, the percent of units and tracts that are HUD subsidized was only 6.8% in Detroit of all housing units. Of course, keep in mind, Detroit has a large vacant and abandoned housing stock. A lot of housing units can't pass inspection and in order to get approved for things like housing choice vouchers. And so that lower percentage of subsidized units in Detroit is partly influenced by things like that. The other thing is Detroit, more than any other city, is a voucher city. 74.9% of the subsidized units in the city of Detroit are housing choice vouchers. That's surprising. And of course, different than what some stereotypes and popular myths might tell you, only 5.6% of those subsidized units in Detroit are public housing. And so most of the public housing in Detroit has been decommissioned or converted for some other purpose. There's been a shift towards vouchers, and that's kind of what's left, a much smaller percentage of public housing in Detroit. When you look at the location of subsidized housing in Detroit, the other thing that really stands out is it's much more concentrated around the core. And it's also much more proximate to anchor institutions than some of the other cities. And that's where you kind of see this big kind of cluster right near downtown Detroit, right near Wayne State University, the University Hospital, and a lot of other medical centers. Here's Henry Ford Hospital up here. Here's where the Detroit riots started. I can go on and on about Detroit. I used to live there. It's a great city. But Detroit looks different. And so that's what the subsidized housing looks like in Detroit. It's also a larger city. It still has over 600,000 people in it. The other thing that's interesting about Detroit, of course, is its population is 83% African American. But it suffers from a great deal of economic distress. And this is all 2012 ACS data. At that time, the average census tract in Detroit had 29% unemployment. The percent of rent, the percent of household income that went towards rent was 43%. That was the highest number for all 10 cities. The poverty rate was also the highest, 39.3%, kind of all flows out of unemployment and low household incomes. And then, the Gini index was about the same in Detroit. And so, yes. Right, there was 23.6% without a high school education. Remember, this is an old industrial city, and a lot of people would find manufacturing jobs in that older age cohort where they'd leave high school early and get a very well-paying job in an automobile plant or some other assembly plant. That type of jobs don't exist anymore in large part, but still that's part of the explanation for a number like that. It's kind of cohort dependent. When you look at Detroit, though, in terms of race, think back to that slide I just showed you a couple slides ago. There's the subsidized housing. There's the African-American population. It's much more concentrated in what would be considered kind of inner ring suburbs within the city of Detroit.
But your first category goes to 78%. Your light category. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, It's relative, but
it's still, relative.
Yeah, I mean, 70.
Those are
70,
quartiles.
75% or 80.
Right.
Because it's such a high.
But still, that is below the mean for the city.
Yeah, that's my
so,
mean.
Yeah. So as you kind of move outward, though, you see the African American percent going up. But it is, making up 86% of the city to begin with. When you look at education, the distribution of people with less than a high school education is distributed very differently in terms of the city. It's mostly concentrated in Southwest Detroit, which is a very different area. It's a lot of older industrial area, more immigrant population than other parts of Detroit. It's kind of that Southwest Latino community is down there, and older kind of white ethnic groups. And then when you look at the poverty rate in Detroit, you get kind of a checkerboard kind of pattern of poverty across census tracts, where it's kind of distributed, you know, in a manner like this. And the next slide is kind of instructive, because when you look at the index of inequality, I'm just going to flip back and forth, and you could see kind of like that flips as well, where what that's really showing is that the higher poverty neighborhoods are much more homogeneous in terms of income. There's not a lot of there's a lot of income isolation in those poverty neighborhoods. If you have a lot of poverty, there's not other groups well represented in those neighborhoods, but these more mixed neighborhoods that kind of border the poverty neighborhoods are kind of clustered closer to the core in other ways. When we look at the housing characteristics in Detroit, another thing that really should jump out at you, first of all, you know, 72.8% of housing units are single-family homes. That was the highest number for the 10 cities. And also, Detroit has a majority homeownership population in terms of housing tenure, which I believe was the only city in our sample like that. And so there is a lot of homeownership comparatively, and also, you know, a lot of single-family homes in Detroit. It's a big, spread-out, kind of suburban-style city once you get outside of the core. But the vacancy rates were the highest as well. And that percent other vacant was also the highest. And so, again, we know that Detroit has a lot of distress in terms of its built environment. And then you can see that, again, here's the single-family home concentration in Detroit, which kind of fans out towards those inner ring suburbs. And here is the vacancy rate, which is kind of more concentrated closer to the core. And then, you know, for our institutional variables, a couple other things. Tracts with hospitals and universities were the smallest percentages of tracts in all of our cities that we examined. And also, another thing that kind of stands out a little bit is that, you know, most tracts had at least one school in them. And even though these performance numbers in terms of only 18% meeting AYP standards and tracts with at least one school not meeting AYP being 29%, were actually, you know, better than most of the other cities that we examined. And so in a relative way, schools were performing a little bit better in Detroit, although we hear a lot about failing schools in Detroit and other cities, and that still is an issue. It hasn't, you know, the numbers aren't as high in Detroit as other cities. And so here's our model I'm going to show you. It's very different than the other ones I've shown before. This is what happened when we ran our regression model in Detroit. Notice socioeconomic distress is not significantly correlated with the location of HUD-subsidized housing. But what is? Well, the percent of subsidized units that were public housing, so those remaining public housing units, tended to be closer to the core. That's what was retained in the city. And now we have anchor institutions coming up as actually the strongest correlates in terms of their standardized coefficients. Oh, I'm sorry. The subsidized housing was, but the other two correlates in terms of increased concentrations of HUD subsidized housing. It's the only model that this happened in when we looked at the 10 separate cities. And so Detroit does have that concentration. You saw it in the original map of where subsidized housing is located, and it's showing up in our model as well.
Isn't that somewhat the positive effect of that, which would seem to be a good thing? Isn't that really offset by the fact that there's so few jobs, period, in the city? I mean, if you've got a ratio of 0.52
right.
jobs to residents, and everybody's, you've got separate public transportation systems to the suburbs where all the jobs are, it's really hard to get out there for what...
Yeah, it's definitely a conundrum, because in Detroit, where things have bottomed out the most in terms of housing and the built environment and depopulation and job loss, what's left, you know, are things like, you know, anchor institutions and you know, existing public investments in subsidized housing that's really firming up some neighborhoods and keeping them from kind of following that trend. And so, you know, there's this question about whether, you know, anchor-based strategies should be pursued to revitalize cities kind of building out from the core, or whether, you know, that's just kind of a condition that becomes more visible and more apparent when there's nothing else left to kind of build an economic base from. And so that becomes the main driver for any kind of economic development. The question is, how much building out can you do with that type of an institutional approach to doing investment and revitalization? But the model is interesting because, you know, Detroit is different, and it's different for the reasons you just mentioned, and also it kind of shows up in our analysis as well. And of course, you know, this ratio of jobs per track to the total population, and that measure needs to be kind of worked on a little bit. It's at least, it's a negative coefficient, which is showing that the subsidized housing isn't clustering near the where job clusters are remaining. And of course, there are big plants that take up an entire track, like the Cadillac plant in Detroit, that kind of contributes to that kind of relationship.
Yeah, because, I mean, just you'd expect them to be going in the same direction if the hospitals and the public, mm-hmm. the colleges and the track were positive, because in lots of other places, they're the biggest employers.
Yeah, and the next step in our analysis is we want to look at adjacent tracks, because a lot of times the hospitals and the universities and also big manufacturing employers, that there still are some in Detroit, and kind of civic center employers, there isn't a lot of housing in those tracks.
Yeah.
Because it's taken up by those institutional buildings. They take up all the space. But it's the tracks right next to them that sometimes you get that spillover effect in terms of affordable housing development. So if you're working with an anchor institution like a university and trying to negotiate, you know, something like a community benefit agreement to have, you know, affordable housing as part of their set-aside strategy or their development strategy, it might not happen right in the same census tract that institution's in, but it has to be within some type of proximity so that those linkages between employment and educational opportunities and housing can be, you know, made stronger. And so that's kind of where we're moving, you know, with our analysis. And I've kind of said all of this stuff. Basically, you know, Detroit is kind of an outlier, and for all those reasons we just discussed. And, you know, the next thing that we're kind of working on now is trying to use some of this analysis to inform the way that we construct a housing suitability model. And we're actually developing separate ones for core cities and suburbs, because the relationships we're finding in terms of some of these demographic and housing characteristics and institutional characteristics are different enough to justify weighting different neighborhood characteristics in a different manner if you're looking at a core city where you're trying to do affordable housing siting versus a suburban area. And so what this particular beginnings of a housing suitability model shows is that we would place kind of more weight on these boxes that represent things like, you know, the housing characteristics, transit access, you know, proximity to anchor institutions, other neighborhood amenities when doing siting. And the idea behind this whole approach is that, you know, our siting model would be built on publicly available data. And so, you know, we're not necessarily looking for the most refined institutional data, but data that's open to access in nature, so that both the institutional members, government, and also community groups can all have access to the same data when they're adjusting weights and trying to figure out where the best locations are for the siting of affordable housing in the future. And taking these types of distributions into consideration in order to get outcomes that link those siting decisions to neighborhoods of opportunity, where residents of that housing would then have opportunities to attend better schools, improve their skills, connect with jobs that might be part of broader development strategies, have access to transit so that they can, you know, commute to work and other places, and also have a variety of neighborhood amenities that aren't necessarily present in the current location of subsidized housing. And like I was saying, you know, our model for the suburbs almost reverses a lot of these measures. And then things like, you know, school performance becomes much more important in the suburban model, because it's not working well currently when we look at things like voucher siting. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about crime? This is the first time I'm seeing it since the first slide, and I'm kind of interested in how that
is. Yeah, crime is an issue we've been trying to, you know, grapple with quite a bit in terms of how to model with it. And it all gets back to the accessibility of good, reliable crime data. And what we've been finding is that, you know, our best crime data is coming from the Uniform Crime Reports, and we can get it at police department levels for, you know, incident reports and aggregate crimes. And what that means is that the kind of models I was just showing you, we wouldn't be using. We'd have to do some type of hierarchical modeling. So that we could look at those fixed effects of crime, say, in a city as a whole, on some of the housing decisions that are take place, you know, at the tract level, because the crime data is just, you know, interestingly enough, it's very hard to find good, reliable crime data. And Lee Yin does a lot of this big data analysis, and she's been looking for kind of either incident level data that reports crime by, you know, the place where police reports were made and other types of crime data, but we haven't really worked through getting the best access to crime data. If people have recommendations for that, that would be great, but across the 10 metropolitan areas, it's kind of tough, especially when you get outside of the core city, because there's just less availability of data. Yes, in the back.
Our struggle with crime data has been that you can only get it at the police department. If the police department, I would think it would be more of a struggle in a larger center city than it would be in an outside suburban area that might have a smaller geographic footprint. But our struggle with crime data has been, you know, it's aggregated. So if the place is very large and very diverse, then there's no way to know where within that large footprint these things are occurring. Ann Lewis from Steel Valley Council of Government. Allegheny County, as you probably know, is massively fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of coordinate our...
We actually contacted your office for the transit data, but that's a different story. And we got all the transit maps. They're great. So.
Probably me.
It's possible. One of my grad students did it.
Yeah. So that's our struggle in trying to. We have just to sort of share with you, although it's not necessarily readily available everywhere. For some of the work that we've done on blight, we've used 911 data as a proxy, because we've been able, we don't care about the details, we just care about the call codes.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been able to get that and get that as, and get it in as point data. So
oh,
that's
okay.
Very helpful.
Yeah, and that's what we're starting to explore with the crime data, because we got police department level data from the Uniform Crime Reports, which is aggregated. But like you said, with the big cities, it's problematic because it's just the whole city. But at least you can get the suburban police departments as well, and they're a little bit easier to, you know, kind of understand, you know, how the crime's distributed in the geography, because they're just smaller areas, and that's the only place to get the suburban data in a lot of cases. But yeah, we're struggling with it. And the if you're talking about the 911 data, is that like the incident report data? I know we downloaded these huge flat files. And just working through them and figuring out how they're structured to get the most out of them.
So we made very nice requests to our emergency management department. And we worked with our police departments and our fire chiefs to kind of reduce the 330 different codes,
uh-huh,
the ones that were relevant for what we were doing. But it's a big data set. You know, we're just one county.
Right, and when we're working with 10 MSAs, and there's sometimes, you know, six or seven counties in one of those MSAs, then it's going to take a little time for us to kind of figure out how to deal with the crime data. Right now, all we've got is the, in a consistent way across all those metropolitan areas is the police department aggregate data, which is good, but like I said, we'd have to use a different type of analysis to kind of incorporate it into this type of a study, which is kind of doing some multi-level modeling, which we can do, but it's just we haven't got the data set up to do it yet.
Question: taking setting.
You want to identify yourself? So yeah,
oh, sure. Okay. My name is Peter Kaplan, a retired housing professional. I financed affordable housing for a number of years, both in Detroit and Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And
we picked the right cities today.
Yeah. And also now serve on the board of the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay.
One of the things that I'm curious about, setting Detroit apart and looking at the other nine cities, can you point to cities that had, where proximity to, where subsidized housing was close to anchors, close to amenities, more favorably located, and there were significant differences in I guess you really weren't looking at the actual residents of these, mm-hmm, of these properties, so you couldn't really say people who were in cities that were closer to amenities, anchors, jobs, etc., were materially better off. The reason I'm asking is that there's going to be a citywide task force on inclusive housing that's going to mm-hmm. be starting soon, and if there were any data to be able to say, okay, we've looked at X number of we've looked at these cities, of which Pittsburgh is one, and we can point to the fact that it's important to, we can point to positive outcomes. Is that something that's captured in your data at all?
Well, that's kind of the next step in this analysis, okay. And one of the things that we're trying to kind of apply for, you know, kind of a continuation grant from HUD for, is to do some more qualitative analysis first by, you know, interviewing people at the hospitals and universities about the different initiatives that they're specifically pursuing. Because, you know, from this data that I was talking about today, you can see that the overall trends in the cities, you know, aren't leaning towards what you were just describing. But there might be specific projects that you know, a university or a hospital is pursuing that do create those types of both residential mixes and outcomes and linkages at a more micro level. And so we're trying to kind of find out where those projects exist and then talk to people at the community level and do more kind of detailed analysis at the neighborhood level about, you know, how well those outcomes are actually being manifested to residents and you know, how many, you know, people are moving into communities to benefit from those opportunities that are being made available and other things. And so that's kind of the next step in our research. Some cities that look promising to at least have those types of clusters of development are places like Cleveland. Pittsburgh comes up on the list, and if you go down to New Orleans because of a different institutional mix, there might be, you know, some other things happening, but it might be more in the larger cities, and we're just starting to scratch the surface on that. And so that's kind of the direction we're moving in, those to get at those specific questions about what mix of institutions, what mix of housing, what types of outcomes you actually get by having a different strategy deciding, or at least having a more focused strategy on linking all those things together, and what's kind of happening out there at the community level in some of the cities where best practices are emerging.
Thank you.
Oh, waiver.
So this, should I introduce myself? We're really back in the sociology department. It's more of a sort of theoretical question. So there's a part of me where I look at your data that it almost seems like the vouchers are being used to sort of reconcentrate poverty, and that the housing stock in a lot of these places, I guess, I imagine would have to pass inspections. But so there's, it identifies the quality housing stock, but it seems like you still see these huge pockets of concentrated poverty even with the vouchers. So the question, I guess, becomes, like, how do you, and the other part of the question was a theoretical question, that there is only so many spaces for these anchor institutions. So the overall question is, I mean, are these vouchers being used to reconcentrate poverty, and are there spaces where you can tie these people into sort of these anchor institutions, and is there enough space available to sort of meet the need for the people who are coming in? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and there's kind of a yes and no answer to that question. I guess, you know, if I had some of the Buffalo data and also the suburban data, at outside of core cities, there is kind of more of a clustering of vouchers that takes place, at least in our analysis. And so we see that, you know, there are tracks where, you know, subsidized housing increases with vouchers. And that's partly because there's not a lot of subsidized housing in suburbs to begin with. And what's out there are like Section 236 housing, kind of senior housing, and also some vouchers that are used outside of the core city. And so there is kind of this movement of poverty where people who have access to those subsidies might be relocating outward and away from anchor institutions, and in some cases into suburban neighborhoods. But the other side of that answer is that, you know, in most cities, you know, the demand for subsidized housing and for vouchers is much greater than the supply. And so the real hardcore poverty neighborhoods sometimes don't have, you know, a lot of subsidized housing because, you know, HUD restricts the use of vouchers in highly impacted neighborhoods, and because, you know, there are waiting lists of 2 to 3 years in some cities to even get a voucher. And so
you can't get on it, and we've had closed waiting lists.
Right? Yeah, and you can't even get on the waiting lists. And so, you know, for very poor households that don't have access to those housing resources, they end up, you know, concentrating in neighborhoods with the lowest cost housing, because you know that's what they where they're able to afford housing, and also in some cases with housing that's in the poorest condition because it's not well maintained and it's declining in its older housing stock and all those other things that are attributed to kind of neighborhood decline and low income non-subsidized housing in general. And so there is kind of that kind of clustering of poverty as well. And of course those neighborhoods aren't always near other resources because of different types of market characteristics taking place. And so there is kind of a yes and no answer to that. I don't remember the last part of your question, but it had something more to do with anchors. But part of our other research is showing that when anchors do kind of connect with neighborhoods and create linkages, a lot of those currently are on the area of linkages to procurement, employment programs, and some training programs linked right back to the institution. But housing is much lower on the list in terms of what types of linkages you might see in a community benefit agreement coming out of an anchor institution. And so part of what our research is saying is that you have to look more closely at the affordable housing piece and have affordable housing for very low AMI groups, average median income groups, so that what housing might be connected to an anchor-based development strategy, hits all the different income levels and not just, ends up impacting kind of the less impoverished groups who need housing assistance.
Have you looked at what policy elements might have impacted the differences between Detroit and Pittsburgh? What's causing, the disparity?
Yeah, I think the main policy impact is kind of the lack of real tight kind of requirements for citing subsidized housing on the HUD side in terms of kind of determining what should be put into something like a housing suitability model. Of course, on the other side, there are things like resistance at the neighborhood level to citing subsidized housing, those NIMBY issues, and at the institutional level, a lot of larger institutions like hospitals and universities don't really kind of do a great deal to include affordable housing in their institutional expansion processes or programs. And so they have to be kind of brought to the table either by local government who might be offering some type of an abatement or some type of a land dedication or some other type of incentive that's needed to kind of do development, or through some type of community pressure to really kind of identify that need in a stronger way to kind of make the institution respond more than it has currently. And so there's kind of like a lack of attention being paid to the issue, and also kind of a lack of precision in how HUD's defining things like opportunity neighborhoods. And even if you look across HUD programs, when you look at things like the Choice Neighborhood Program, an opportunity neighborhood is really a neighborhood devoid of opportunity, where the housing investment is seen as a way to create all these other kind of multipliers, if you want to think of it that way, in terms of new jobs and improved schools and other investments that take place from partners with Choice Neighborhoods. And what we're kind of suggesting is that there should be another strategy to site housing where those opportunities already exist, rather than to rebuild neighborhoods where their opportunities are devoid currently. And so that's kind of the flip side of that strategy. Both are important, but really the neighborhood of opportunity strategy isn't being pursued as actively as the opportunity neighborhood strategy, at least in core cities. I guess I'll go here and there and there.
Oh. Well, I actually just wanted to let you expand a little bit on what you just said, because how many neighborhoods of opportunity were there in each of these cities? You said that we should focus on concentrating our policies towards them, but to what extent do they exist?
Well, right, and that's what that next step of the research is really focusing on, going to the anchor institutions and the surrounding communities, and first of all, figuring out how to define the boundaries of a neighborhood of opportunity. And so how they define their footprint in the community, how they define areas they're trying to impact for development, and then understanding what mixes of amenities are present within those boundaries, so that we could say this area would be a neighborhood of opportunity where affordable housing should be added to the equation for future development planning. And that really takes that qualitative analysis piece to kind of go on a city-by-city basis and find those those mixes of amenities and institutions where the recommendations for affordable housing can be made. And so that's what the suitability model. Right, because first you have to kind of get into the communities and get the boundaries clearly delineated, and so that you understand how, what's happening currently in terms of development, and also what opportunities there are to add missing pieces to it. And so that's kind of the next step in this analysis, to use some of this baseline data to then go and carve out those boundaries of the neighborhoods, and then, make more specific recommendations about how housing mixes should be, addressed in order to create more opportunity for lower income groups.
And Tracy Sausman from the School of Social Work. You mentioned very early on that there's this kind of elephant in the room of gentrification that goes along with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
When you're creating communities of opportunity, where you're trying to increase low-income housing or affordable housing in those communities, it's also an area where there's a high targeting of upscale housing, new development, that goes counter to that. So part of it is always the balance that you're trying to create.
Right.
How are you looking at that gentrification issue?
Yeah, once we understand kind of what the current composition of housing is, the goal would be to come up with a strategy to preserve, the existing stock of affordable housing and upgrade it, if it needs to be improved, but also to add affordable housing in those communities that are gentrifying. Because if gentrification is taking place at the neighborhood level, that also means that the cost of housing and other entry issues are becoming more difficult for low-income groups. And so, part of what we're trying to do with the housing suitability model is look for those areas that would otherwise turn over entirely in terms of income, become very homogeneous but kind of, more exclusive, and carve out, a certain proportion of housing either through things like density bonuses for developers or through some type of inclusionary zoning or some other technique to guarantee that affordable housing is both, placed in those areas and also preserved over time. And of course, some of the current, HUD programs, once they kind of sunset and run out of time, like low-income housing tax credits, there's always the risk that they can go market rate. And some of them start out at higher AMIs as well, so that's a problem too. And so what we're really looking at is how to include more affordable housing in development strategies around anchor institutions that also connects with the lower AMI groups, like the 30% AMI instead of 80. And that's a real challenge, for a number of reasons, at multiple layers, but the discussion has to happen before you can start addressing it. And so we're trying to kind of come up with those boundaries like I was talking about, identify the areas, make the argument for why connecting with the resources in those neighborhoods would be beneficial to the residents of the housing, and then also, point out that you need a tiered housing structure so that people can cycle up in housing and make those units available for the next group of low-income residents looking for the benefits of living in those opportunity-rich neighborhoods.
Ron Gatos, I do the economic community and economic development consulting. So I was wondering, in a lot of the areas of study, there are going to be so-called suburban communities that are really part of the urban core, but not officially.
Right.
Lackawanna and Buffalo, we have all kinds of other post-industrial towns around here.
Mm-hmm.
Would that, looking at those differently or including them as core, or just keeping them as suburban in the suburban census tract group for the study, does that kind of muddy the waters in your contrast of the characterization in your models of the core versus suburban?
Yeah, I guess you're really talking about those older inner ring industrial suburbs, and Lackawanna is a great example. Which suitability model or what, if you think of kind of a continuum along that type of modeling, where certain characteristics will become weighted heavy, larger than others, to apply, you'd have to do it on a tailored way to the local community characteristics. So a place like Lackawanna, is going to be much more like a core city suitability model than a suburban suitability model. If you're thinking, like an Orchard Park, you know, kind of affluent suburb. And Lackawanna's needs are much more like Buffalo's, although the institutional kind of component, the anchor component, might not be as strong. So something else like, you know, really focusing more on siting near high-performing schools, which is also problematic in that type of a community, or some other amenity might be, you know, a different approach to take in this community like that. But the idea is that we would identify, you know, a core base of public data that groups that have an interest in pursuing affordable housing development could plug into, and then, you know, refine their weights on those measures so that they could get the right mix of amenities to make recommendations for, you know, the most opportunity-rich areas in a particular setting. And of course, the public component, you know, the public accessibility of data is real important, so that when a community group that kind of does their analysis goes to a planning meeting and talks to the city and a developer or a large institution that wants to, you know, do development in a particular area, they're all working with the same data, and so they're comparing apples to apples, you know, throughout that process. And then they can talk about how they're weighting things and have that substantive discussion about what types of benefits they're trying to connect residents to, rather than kind of have a lot of different data that then, you know, you get into, you know, whose data is the best rather than, you know, whose priorities are most important for development kind of discussion. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Nathan Dorfman. I'm a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh.
Hi, Nathan.
Studying public administration. This summer, I'm actually biking across the country to raise money for affordable housing. So this
is
really exciting and interesting to me. I'm curious, though, in the inner ring suburbs, what best practices can you think of for bringing affordable housing programs there? And I would be thinking of places like in the Mon Valley or older industrial suburbs. So I agree that those areas can be overlooked sometimes.
Yeah, and they are, and they're getting more attention now. And really, what's happening in a lot of inner ring suburbs is, you know, people who have access to housing choice vouchers and various types of rent subsidies are increasingly kind of migrating to those areas as more, you know, housing becomes, you know, available for renters. And so the question about, you know, how that impacts, you know, low income groups, if they're actually moving to places where they're benefiting from that type of mobility, or if they're just kind of moving poverty from one location to another, which is kind of the question Waverly brought up, has become like a real kind of point of discussion. And so the policies would link back to, you know, thinking through how things like vouchers are actually, you know, used and how the change in the composition of neighborhoods is taken into consideration as vouchers are being approved for areas where they haven't traditionally been, in like an inner ring suburb. Because what we see is that inner ring suburbs are becoming kind of, you know, more impoverished in the contemporary period as kind of the core of a core city, you know, revitalizes, as gentrification takes place, as you know, kind of middle income and upper income populations move more out to exurban areas, and those older inner ring suburbs start to take on some of the characteristics of kind of, you know, kind of the suburban neighborhoods in core cities today. And so, you know, if that pattern isn't to continue, then some policies, you know, in terms of targeting where vouchers are used and having more inclusionary zoning and fair share housing throughout an entire metropolitan area would have to be factored in more.
Any places that are using like sort of the model that you're describing of intentionally is there anyone actually doing that?
Well, you know, we've been looking at community benefit agreements as another part of this analysis, and trying to understand how linkages are being, you know, negotiated with large institutions that are expanding their footprint and their campuses in general. And what we've seen is that where those link development agreements are taking place, it's in cities like Cleveland, and Cleveland is kind of cited often as kind of the model for this. But, you know, housing isn't as prominent in the linkage agreements as things like employment and workforce development and set-asides for procurement and contractors, and even some like transportation to work programs and things of that nature. It's been a piece of the puzzle at a lower level in some cases, but it hasn't been as prominent. And when you get outside of the shrinking cities, You know, you could look where some of those types of negotiations are taking place, like in with the Columbia University expansion, where there's been a lot of contested planning going on over affordable housing and housing in general, because of the fear that gentrification will kind of take place around Columbia's expansion project. And so, you know, there are some models out there where housing has been tied in with institutional expansion, but they're kind of few and far between. It's kind of an emerging thing, because these types of agreements, you know, at this level, not just a development agreement, but more broad-based CBAs, have only been around for about 10 years, you know, for the most part. And you know, even in Pittsburgh, they cite the arena project in Pittsburgh in the Hill District is one of the best practices for this. And I know Sabina and I were having a little conversation about that, and it's been, you know, not necessarily as a best practice as you would think at the local, when you start talking to people at the local level. There's still a lot of concerns about housing mixes and things like that, but at least housing has come into the discussion. And so people look at those examples as places where it's been done, and they try to model their agreements, you know, based loosely on how those types of developments have unfolded.
Ian? I wanted to say I applaud your attention to the sort of suburban and exurban areas, because in many cases, certainly not all, the anchor institutions are in the core. Certainly Allegheny County is more extreme than other places, but the suburban communities have significantly less capacity to enter the dialogue. You know, they have less professional capacity, they have less political capacity, they have less financial capacity. And so, I mean, we've found in our study that issue of capacity and size is more relevant than anything else when it comes to blighted property. So, you know, I really, it's encouraging to, you know, hear these conversations and the recognition that, you know, our suburban ring is really important. And if our inner core is strong and our suburban ring is not, then our region is not strong. And so I applaud you for that, because it's a really different phenomenon. Really learn when you're in it.
Yeah, yeah, and the absence of anchors in the suburbs, it's an issue that as we're thinking about modeling, you know, like suitability models, comes up a lot. And the thing that is kind of a more of a neighborhood based anchor in the suburbs are the schools, and it, you know, it becomes a bigger, you know, component of that type of a system for doing sustained suitability, housing suitability. Housing suitability analysis for siting. When we look at the suburbs, because high-performing schools are kind of like, you know, the thing to really focus on in terms of where to locate, you know, affordable housing in the suburbs. And the pattern that we're seeing in some of our analysis is that where affordable housing is going in the suburbs, partly because of that inner ring suburb issue, is into districts and also into neighborhoods where the schools are having the most problems meeting their AYPs consistently. And so kind of getting an approach that moves affordable housing into a broader spectrum of neighborhoods in the suburbs is a key to kind of making those connections, the linkages that a lot of subsidized households are looking for in suburbs, like, you know, good education for their kids. And of course, the LODES data where we're looking at employment concentrations is also important, because that becomes a much more important consideration when you're siting housing in the suburbs. Because even if people get, you know, access to affordable housing in the suburbs, sometimes they're not able to, you know, have job access and educational access and transit access in those areas because of those kind of lower capacity levels in those public services that you're talking about.
I was wondering if any of the cities you look at have laws that make it illegal to discriminate based on source of income.
Well, I know that Buffalo does, in terms of what the fair housing ordinances, and also some of the couple of the suburbs in our metropolitan area does.
Any impact on voucher location?
Well, there's having a law and enforcing it. They're kind of two separate things. And like in at least in Buffalo, enforcement's been a real problem, and even staffing, you know, that office that's supposed to, you know, vet those complaints. And also the number of units that are required to actually have the law apply to a landlord is an issue as well, because you have to think have more than four units in a structure. And so that kind of takes most of the affordable housing off the table in the city. And so the impact has been relatively low, although if you have a local nonprofit that can, you know, file the complaints and kind of walk them through the HUD process, you know, when a good income-based case comes up, then there's a vehicle to at least pursue that. And so I guess the threat is always out there. But it's a kind of milestone just to get the ordinance on the books. Then it's a real struggle to kind of get it enforced.
As the moderator, I'll take the last question, which is only perspective. Rob, 20 plus years ago here, Cheryl Saunders was part of a suit against we have three housing authorities, City of Pittsburgh, Housing Authority, City of Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Allegheny County Housing Authority, and McKeesport Housing Authority, and we had a consent decree about the problem was exactly concentrated subsidized housing in the rest of Allegheny County. Just a little preview of what we might expect from some of the suburban pieces as you go through your analysis, and
okay.
We'll leave it on the prospective part of your research and end there.
All right, great. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.